We don't have to wait for someone else to tell our stories. We need to write our stories. When I say we, I mean all groups of people, everyone. It's important that we tell our stories. We're not going to rewrite history. You know, we're not going to, it's not good for any of us. We need to know the truth, share the history. It's American history.
Welcome to Voices of Esalen. I'm Sam Stern. Today we feature a conversation with the historian Jan Batiste Adkins, author of African Americans of San Francisco, African Americans of Monterey County, and African Americans of San Jose and Santa Clara County. In recent times, this essential piece of our nation's saga is facing challenges and censorship across the country, making it all the more crucial we reaffirm our commitment to honoring and understanding our shared history. Our discussion today is not just a journey through the past. It's a conversation about the importance of preserving these narratives in the face of attempts to erase them. Jan Adkins' work meticulously documents the rich history of Black people in these regions, shedding light on the experiences of these communities. This conversation was recorded live at Esalen in late February of 2024.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is my first time coming here. I was nervous, but it was wonderful seeing all the beautiful trees, the ocean, the view. It's just spectacular. Yay. So thank you very much for inviting me. Yeah. It's a real treat.
Absolutely. What led you to start this research, and how did you do this research and this writing?
Well, that was sort of it was by accident, I should say. I was in grad school at San Jose State, and at that time I was teaching high school English, and we're reading The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, and my students, they just in the middle of the class said to me, "Well, what were Black people doing during this time?" I said, "Oh, okay." And of course, you know, as an educator, we're supposed to say, "Well," and give this educated, you know, response. But I said, "I don't know." Because various cultures are not depicted in our literature. And I told them, I said, "But let's find out." And so I told them, I challenged them. I said, "You know what? You need to go home and start doing some research on your own about your family. Find out about your community and what kind of people live in your community. If you have African Americans in your communities, if you have Irish people, Italian, whatever, all of the cultural and ethnic groups, go and do the research and find out and come back and let's talk about it." I mean, I'm thinking I'm giving them an assignment. I'm pushing it back on them, you know. Regardless of your cultural groups, go home and do your research. And then students looked at me and they said, "Well, what about you? Can you tell us? What do you know?" And I told them, I said, "Okay, here's the deal. I will do research on African Americans in our communities, and you can go home and do research about your family and your communities and how you guys came. Mm-hmm. Why are you here? And this is indigenous land in the first place. How did we all get here?" And so I challenged my students, and they took the challenge, and they went home and did the research, their families. And in the meantime, they were asking me almost every day, "Well, what did you find out? Did you find out anything?" And so I'm like, "Yes, I did. I have." And I started researching. At that time, I was finishing my master's, and I thought, I would like to write my thesis on a topic that deals with African Americans. But this is literature, right? Not a history class. So I wanted to know, we were studying California literature, and we read, in our anthology, I didn't find one piece, not a poem or short story or a narrative about an African American family. And I thought, well, this is really strange. Why am I? So I challenged my instructor. I said to her, I said, "You know, why is it that we're reading about California literature and I don't find California literature written in? Why isn't the African American experience included?" She said, "It's not included in the book. I guess there were very few people that wrote." And at that point, I said, "No, there must be, and there's another reason." And I started researching. I told her, I said, "That's my master's thesis. I'm going to find out about African American writers during that time." She said, "Well, there weren't any writers." And I'm thinking to myself, It's like the door opened. All of a sudden, I found out that the Black newspapers started with William Lloyd Garrison, who was white, abolitionist, from the East Coast. Then he sent his writers to his reporters to California, and they began researching the African American communities. Three newspapers were published in San Francisco: the Mirror of the Times, the Pacific Appeal, and the Elevator newspapers. And those newspapers were published by African Americans. And so what I discovered, so you're probably thinking, okay, so we have the title of newspapers, right? Well, how did I read the newspapers? I had to go to the libraries in San Francisco, and they had them on microfilm, and I had to read the newspapers, and it was just amazing. And there I found out short stories were published about the communities on the way to different cities, you know, Napa, on the way to Napa, the community of Napa, you know, on Sacramento, San Jose, Santa Cruz. And there are all these wonderful stories. And then I found lots of poetry, writing poems about experiences and short stories and then narratives and then editorials and reports about different things going on in the communities, different churches and all the different social groups and different businesses and all the experiences. And I started reading the black newspapers, and it was on microfilm, and that really opened the door. And so I wrote my master's thesis about the African-American newspapers of San Francisco, 1850 to 1899. And my master's thesis was published, and I was just really excited. I thought, oh, my gosh. And at San Jose State, I won the Harvey Birnbaum Award for that year that I graduated. And so it was really amazing. So over that year, I was able to report back to my students what I discovered from the black newspapers. And after that, I couldn't stop.
Can you share with us when and why the first African Americans moved to California?
Well, we would assume that African Americans came to California after the Civil War. We would assume, but that's not true. In the 1500s, an Afro-Spaniard, he was from Morocco, his name was Estevanco, came to the New World, which is the New World, New Spain, with an explorer. And he came to New Spain in 1527. He came up through Florida. He was a guide. And they came across Florida, New Mexico, Texas, into Mexico. Because remember, that California wasn't a state at the time. No. Hmm. And the United States didn't exist. So this was Mexican territory. Into Mexico, and then on up into what was known as Lower California. He was a guide. And he was killed. Eventually, he died. There were four people, and he was one of African heritage. And he died in battle with the indigenous people. In my Monterey book, I talk about in 1770, Alexo Nino, who's a Spaniard, came to Monterey with Father Juniper Serra. And he was a cocker on a ship. And he was buried right at the Presidio. And there's a cross. And in my Monterey book, you'll see whoever is looking at that book, there's a cross in the Presidio where he was buried. And Father Juniper Serra performed the last rites and also his ceremony, burial ceremony. And this is documented. So we know that those two people were here in the 1700s. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, that's it, right? And then I started writing my San Jose book. And in my San Jose book, I found out that the Pueblo, El Pueblo de Guadalupe, say San Jose de Guadalupe, the first town in California was established by people of African and Hispanic culture. Our first governor, Pio Pico, was of African and Mexican heritage. He was born 1801 in what was called at that time New Spain. The Spaniards were not bringing people from Spain into California to fight the Indians. No, they weren't doing that. The indigenous people, they brought laborers. They brought people who were the working class, mm-hmm. the lower class. They were not the landowners. And so the people that they brought were people that were people of African heritage. They were indigenous people, people who had mixed race people from Mexico and from other places, from the Caribbean islands. They traveled from the Caribbean islands and migrated over into Mexico. You know, the slavery first started in South America, came up from Brazil and migrated up through South America. And then so the opportunity to go and has helped to establish a town, to grow the agriculture, to work. I mean, people took advantage of that, and they were willing to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's who the Spaniards brought into the New World, into New Spain. And then after the Spanish-Mexican War and that territory became part of Mexico, then once again, there was still that integration going on, mm-hmm. Integration of cultures. So it wasn't like the establishment of slavery in America. It wasn't slavery necessarily. So let's get away from that word. But in Mexico, these were just laborers, and they interracially married. And then they were able to, and then they took jobs, and they were able to come into what is called Alta California after the 1830s, after the Spanish Mexican War. So those were the first, that's how the first families came. They came to work, to till the soil, they came to explore, they came to discover a new world.
Reading your book, you wrote that many enslaved African Americans, they were able to buy their freedom or escape slavery once they're in the West.
Before California became a state, there were people who were enslaved people who were brought into California. So I don't want to imply that all African people of African heritage who came to California were enslaved. There weren't. There were some free men and women also who came. But those who came during the gold rush, they came because the southern plantation owners wanted to mine the gold. And they also came because to labor, to work. Some wanted to establish agricultural farms and things. The enslaved people came. Those miners, there was a place, a plot of land called Negro Hill. And it's if you go over to Placer County, you'll see a little plaque of where this hill was. And this is where black miners were able to mine because white miners wanted to have their own land and black miners had their land, their little plot, and then black miners mined that particular land. Black enslaved people mined wherever the white plantation owner had them mine. And at nighttime and often when they were not working, they went to Negro Hill and other places to work. So they were able to mine at Negro Hill, but they're also able to work. They cooked, they were clean, they did all kinds of work for white miners, and they were able to keep their money. Well, they also had a contract with their owners that they would be able to buy their freedom. So, and they were able to buy their freedom for about $1,000. There's a story of Alvin Coffey, who was a miner, and that's exactly how he was able to buy his freedom. He was told that it would cost him $1,000 to buy his freedom. He worked nights. He worked when he was off times. Then he was able to pay his owner. And the owner said, and the owner also owned his children and his wife, and he was also able then to work extra for this particular owner, and his entire family was freed, and he was able to bring them from Virginia to back to California, and they established their residence in San Francisco, Oakland, and eventually Shasta Mountains. Wow. When they moved up in that area. There are so many stories. George Denison came with his family in the 1849s. His father, who owned him, brought him with his brothers, who were white. And he worked in a hotel in San Francisco. And during off hours, he was able to work. And he was able to save his money. He bought his freedom from his father, his white father. And he was able to establish a stable for animals. He became very wealthy. He established a stable and he worked. And he was able to use his money to help to work with the abolitionists in San Francisco to free the other slaves who wanted freedom too. Then there were those who were freed by the courts. So what happened is in California was considered a free state. Because California was a free state, what that meant is that if a slave was brought to California before 1850, then they were considered ownership of that property. They were property. But if a person was brought to California after California became a free state, they had to be freed. And so what happened is that there was a big abolitionist movement of white and black people came together. They were abolitionists, they had lawyers, and they were able to work with those slaves, and they took those cases to court. And the courts released gave them manumission papers, which were their freedom papers, and they were able to. I had the opportunity to see. I mean, I really didn't see them, but I had in my book, I talk about manumission papers for two people in my San Jose book, Samson Gleaves and another person. What happened is that I was at History Park San Jose, and I just asked the question. I said, did that happen in Santa Clara County? Did Santa Clara County courts free any slaves? She says, as a matter of fact, we have the original manumission papers. In my book, I have photographs of the actual manumission papers. And so the courts in Santa Clara County and the courts throughout the state, they were able to free the slaves because the law said that if the slave was brought into California after statehood, that they could not be maintained as a slave. Mm-hmm. But if they were brought into California before statehood, then they were the property owner. Mm-hmm. Then there was a fugitive slave law that also said, well, if they were a runaway, but they were brought here before 1850, then they were not free. Beckwith, James Beckwith, Beckwith Pass, he was a slave. Mm. And but his father freed him in I believe it was Kansas. And he was freed, and it's in my Monterey book. And he was freed, and then he went and lived with the Crow Indians. And then he traveled across the country, and he also, after he left the Crow Indians, he led different overland groups that were moving, that were, you know, pioneers coming to California. He was a guide. He led them to California up through the Sahara Pass, and the Sahara Pass now is known as Beckwith Pass. And so he was freed because he worked and he was able to buy his freedom from his father. And so that happened. I mean, it was common. You know, I always like to say that it's nothing that we need to be ashamed of. That's the history of our country, and it should be in our history books. Because out of it, there are many people that were opposed to slavery. They worked together. The Quakers, they were a part of the Underground Railroad and helped to lead people from the South into Canada. There were so many different groups, and we should be proud. It's American history. We should be proud of our history. Talk about it. Understand it so that we don't repeat some of those negative things that happened in the past.
What was life like for the African Americans who were free people in California pre-Civil War? What challenges did they face in life?
First of all, many of them came to California and established community. That was the first thing. And the community started with the establishment of the church and the social groups and organizations. The second thing, well, let me back up. Mm-hmm. The first was probably the establishment of businesses, because we found the haberdashery shops in San Francisco were established, and these were black men that owned their shops. Women, Mary Pleasant, who established a boarding house for women who came to California and without spouses or mates and didn't have a place to live. So there was a boarding house for women. Later on, if you read about Mary Pleasant, they said it was a bordello, but, you know, you know, there's a lot, many, many different stories about her. But anyway, so she was a woman who started a boarding school for girls, for women. There were haberdashery shops. There were shoeshine businesses. There were barber shops. And all these businesses were established. And then there were also laborers. Many people worked on the farms. There were servants. Many people worked in the homes as servants and taking care of children. So there are many different types of jobs. Many worked in the bars and worked, maintaining and doing that kind of work. And then the church was probably the most important aspect of the black community, and it still is today. I saw on PBS there's a special on the gospel and the black church. Well, that really happened. So every community has several churches. So the church was a social center where people went and they socialized and as well as had the spiritual development. But in addition to the church were schools. And these schools were called colored schools. And so schools were established in California, starting in San Francisco with a school. In my San Francisco book talks about the schools in San Francisco, Sacramento, San Jose. These schools were established for kids. And now it was interesting because they weren't limited just to black kids. Native American kids, indigenous kids were able to attend, and also Chinese and Asian kids who couldn't attend schools, the segregated schools, were able to go to the colored schools. They called them colored schools because that meant people of all were non-white. Those schools really identified for non-white. So San Jose established what is called St. Philip's Mission School, and that school was a school. From there, then they developed the Dixonian Academy. And in my book, I show a newspaper advertisement. It says San Jose's Colored School, and that was a school for all children who were of any race. And that came out of the church. Mm-hmm. And that was a very important. Many parents felt that they may or may not have had the opportunities for education, but they wanted their kids to have opportunities for education. So the first school was established in the 1850s. The first churches were established in the 1850s. So California was really interesting. Santa Clara County was the first county to integrate its schools. So we had segregated schools until 1877. And by 1877, then the school board decided that they were not going to fund the so-called color schools, that they wanted everyone to attend one school, and they were going to fund one school. And then the parents actually were upset because parents felt that they're paying taxes and they're paying for schools, yet they had to also support this private school, the colored school. So what happened is that the school district in Santa Clara County, and I think it began to move throughout the state, then integrated its schools. So schools were actually integrated in California. But here's a little thing I found out as I was researching, that it was not integrated for indigenous people. So if you're a Native American, you know. And that didn't happen until 1940s. So really sad to say. But that was the first step towards integrating the schools, and that happened in 1877. So I think that we have a lot to be proud of, too, you know, in California, you know, so. So when you talk about the early community of the 1800s and the mid-1800s before the Civil War, there were laws that said that black, it wasn't just black, but people of color could not testify against a white person. And my example of that is Peter Lester and Mifflin Gibbs of San Francisco in the 1850s owned a haberdashery shop, and that's a men's shoes and clothing shop and things like that, hats. So a white person went into the shop, and they could not, and he stole some shoes, and then he got in a fight with Lester, assaulted Lester and Mifflin Gibbs, who were the owners of the shop, and they could not press charges at all. And it wasn't just a black person, but an indigenous person could not testify against a white person either. So that was a law that happened, and it was overturned shortly after. Because of the 13th and 14th Amendment that abolished slavery and that also gave citizens rights, then those laws were abolished and blacks were able to testify. Mm. So that was one of the biggest problems, is that there wasn't the protection under the law, and for people non-white people. California had a fugitive slave law which only lasted 3 years. So that was the fugitive slave law, then would send slaves back to, but the court, then you had some slaves going back, but some slaves were being freed by the courts, and finally the law expired in 3 years, and California did not pursue that law after that. So those were black codes, and it was difficult for people, and those were not just black people, but people of color had to deal with that. By the turn of the century, many people from the South were migrating. The Great Migration went into the Midwest, Chicago, went to the East Coast, and some came out West. Mm-hmm. What was really kind of interesting, I think, about the migration is that at the turn of the century, the population in, for instance, in San Francisco was at 1,600. But by 1840s, it grew to 4,800. By 1950, it grew to 43,000. You had 1,600 at the turn of the century, 4,000 40 years later, and then 20 years later, the population begins to increase. In Monterey County, there were 84 in Monterey County at the turn of the century. 84, these were people of African heritage. By 1940, 435, and by 1950, 2,000. So 10 years later, a large increase in numbers. So what does that say? What that says basically, in Monterey we know that many people came because they were able to work in homes and in businesses of the developers in Monterey County, of the property owners. In San Francisco, once again, being a large urban center, people of color were able to find jobs, able to work, and we had that massive movement from the South to the North. And those who came to California were able to work, worked as laborers, and were able to find work. But then after World War II, there was a large increase, and of course after, by the 1980s, 1990s, it began to decrease again, because many people who invested in the communities took their investments out of the communities and moved back east, Midwest, back down, back south. Mm-hmm. So you had that movement of people. The military was desegregated in about 1948. And after desegregation, after World War II, what happened is that there were black military men who became officers. And they could not send those officers back to the military establishments in the South because of segregation and practices of segregation. So in other words, a white person from the South doesn't want to be supervised or, you know, has officer, commissioned officer, a black person. So you had that problem. So what they did was that they sent black officers to Fort Ord.
To a more liberal atmosphere.
More liberal environment. Wow. Exactly, exactly. And so that was, and not only to Fort Ord, but other places where segregation had not been established. Mm-hmm. And that is why so many of the black officers that were sent to Fort Ord, black military men and women that were sent to Fort Ord, were officers, because those commissioned officers couldn't go anyplace else. They had to come here. And so you had a large number. I write about that in my book. I had a chance to interview individual families and individual retirees from the military who talked about those early years. There was also an issue where some of the military men would marry women of other ethnic groups. I interviewed a man who married a woman from Germany, and they raised their kids right here in Seaside. And they eventually moved from Seaside to Monterey, and they raised their kids, and then my family moved to up north a little bit. But yeah, and in that case, he said that it was very difficult for him to bring his wife, who was German, back to the States. And so they had to find a place where they could live. And so they were able to live here in Monterey County. Yeah.
When you were doing research about San Francisco, were you under the impression that it was a kind of a liberal place? Or was it subject to the same kind of segregation and such that we saw in the rest of the country?
So there was something different going on there. You had what was called de facto. So you had something that was not necessarily clearly stated. It was a practice. It was more like practice, like restrictive covenants. You know, so restrictive covenants was established as a part of the mortgaging tool on property. But then when it was discontinued, it was like de facto practice of restrictive covenants, meaning that an owner may not want to sell his property to a person of color. Mm-hmm. You know, and a neighborhood wants to maintain the neighborhood status and may not want a person of color. So that was what was going on. Also urban renewal. So urban renewal was established in San Francisco, and in neighborhoods that had a high minority of African Americans, those homes were destroyed. And now let's back up. I don't want to just say the homes were destroyed. The homes were old. Okay, turn of the century property. So by 1965, 1970, you know, something had to happen, right? So some of the homes in my book, I have a picture of a home that was put on the back of a truck and was moved to another community. So some homes were actually demolished and some homes were moved from the communities, because that particular part of San Francisco, well, they wanted to build a freeway, but that particular part of San Francisco was old and had old and dilapidated housing. Mm-hmm. But who lives in old and dilapidated housing? People of low income, people who may not be able, and the communities, also the communities at one time was a Jewish community, now became an African. So we had that rotation of the housing stock. You know, rotation. And so what happened is that many people of African heritage who lived in the houses that were already old, that had to come down, moved into the South Bay, okay. Moved into East Palo Alto and other places like that, and reestablished themselves in their into other communities. There's a lot of research that's being done now, especially with this whole restitution and problems, you know, trying to decide what to do about slavery and how to compensate families and things like this. And they're doing a lot of research, and they're finding that there was a movement of people that happened that probably didn't have to happen quite that way, but it happened. Mm-hmm. And so displacement of people. But we see it now with gentrification. You know, people want to move back, and they want to move back into town. They want to move back in the major urban centers, you know. And so young people are saying, I don't care. I'm not worried about the ethnic groups or the urban centers. I want to live there. And so sometimes the homes and the neighborhoods become gentrified, and, mm-hmm. and they're taken over by younger people or another ethnic group. And that the ethnic group in the neighborhood, and there's a pull, and there's a tug, and a... You know, and they have to learn to live together and understand each other and appreciate each other. And so, That's a problem.
In terms of those restrictive housing covenants that you were talking about, is that mm-hmm. kind of the reason why Seaside became more African-American rather than Monterey?
Exactly, because of restrictive covenants, they weren't able to buy homes in Monterey. But also, Seaside was, at the time when African-Americans moved into Seaside, it was used as like a dump space. But what happened is that the county, I guess, decided to start cleaning it up, and that was land that was of lesser, that was cheaper than Monterey land in Monterey or in Salinas and other places. So this is where African Americans could buy property, and they were able to buy it and establish it. Yeah.
What about influence in the arts and entertainment in San Francisco and in Monterey County?
Particularly in San Jose, there was a sculptress by the name of Edmona Lewis. Her work was brought to San Jose in 1873. Her work was purchased by Sarah Knox, the Knox Foundation, who owned the Knox Building. And she didn't know that Edmona Lewis was a black woman. So she invited Edmona Lewis to come to San Jose to show her work. And she discovered, she had a sculpture piece of, and it's in my San Jose book, of Abraham Lincoln. And then there's a sculpture piece of two children. And there are other pieces too. And Edmona Lewis loved the sculptures. Sarah Knox loved the sculptures, the sculpture pieces. And so she invited Edmona Lewis to come. And when she found she was a black woman, she loved it anyway. And so she bought the pieces and she donated those pieces before she died. They were donated to the San Jose Library.
Mm-hmm.
Today, those pieces are still in the library on the fifth floor with Edmona Lewis's picture next to the pieces. And so it's still celebrated. So she was one of the first black sculptures in the United States. Then there was also Burt Williams, a vaudeville performer in the 1890s. He traveled around the country, became very famous. Emma Grant was in 1873. She was an actress, and she performed Topsy in Uncle Tom's Cabin. That was performed in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And that was a Broadway play. But probably the most successful person was Ivy Anderson. And she was from Gilroy. She was born and raised in Gilroy. And she was born in 1901. And she went to Gilroy High School. And by 1917, she decided she wanted to be, she was a singer. She loved singing. And she joined the Duke Ellington Band. And she sang all over the world. Mm-hmm. And today, it was really interesting how I found out about her. I was visiting the Gilroy Historical Society, and I said to them, "Well, what do you have in here? What, do you have any black pioneers? We have any?" They said, "Oh yes, Ivy Anderson," and they had lots of information about Ivy Anderson, but they didn't have any photographs. And they said, "Well, you know what? If you go down to this, it was a instrument shop, music instrument shop, and he said, if you go to that instrument shop, the owner there might know something about Ivy Anderson." I went. And I'm looking, I walk in the shop, and I said, "Oh, what is this? It looked like a Western, cowboy Western, you know, music." And I'm like, "Oh, I don't think this is the right place." And the guy said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm doing research on Ivy Anderson." "Oh, Ivy Anderson, yes. My dad and mom, they loved Ivy Anderson." And then she had, on the wall back in his office, he showed me, he had all these pictures of Ivy Anderson, her with Duke Ellington.
Made of wood, I got it fed, and that ain't good.
I noticed also in your Monterey book a picture of Langston Hughes.
That was around 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Carmel was like a place that folks would go to.
Yeah, Carmel was a place that attracted the artist. And so Langston Hughes often came to Carmel. He stayed with a white writer at the time. And so he was often seen here in Monterey, in Carmel.
What surprised you when you were doing this research?
Oh my gosh, all that was surprising. I think when I started out, from the newspapers, I knew, I thought, oh my gosh, there's so much here, there's so much information. But it's like you start digging, and there's stories after stories were revealed, and I think the number one thing that surprised me were that there are so many archivists in the area who love history, and they collect history, and they know of all the little secret places where you can find this particular information, and the historical societies. If they make it their, these are people who love history, and they make it their business just to store historical information for the next generation. And so that really surprised me a lot about the, and also their willingness to share and to communicate. And I just had so many people that were just willing to share information with me, and that was really warm. It gave me such a warm feeling that there are people who really love history, and they're regardless of ethnicity, they're willing to share whatever the knowledge and the information they have found.
During this moment when certain people in government, they're actively working towards replacing and erasing African American history, what does it mean to you as a historian and as a teacher to be doing the work that you're doing?
I mean, it's just horrible, you know, that slavery that gave slaves learn new trades, you know, that's horrible. So, but I was so happy to see the response, though. I think people around the country feel that there's a need to continue to discover new things about different cultural groups and to share those ideas and share the history. It's American history. And that we're not going to rewrite history, you know. We're not going to. It's not good for any of us. we need to know the truth, you know. We need to understand so we can understand each other, you know. And so it was discouraging, but it was encouraging to see the responses all over the country. People, educators, and people, you know, people were not happy with that statement that DeSantis made.
Yeah.
Was not good.
I mean, I can only imagine how it hit you as an author of African American history.
Well, I wrote this poem called "If We Don't Tell Our History, Who Will?" And so I've always felt that it's important. It's important that we tell our stories. You know, we don't have to wait for someone else to tell our stories. We need to write our stories. When I say we, I mean all groups of people. Doesn't matter what, you know. Everyone should write your story. And should share your story with other people. Share your stories with your family. Share your stories in your communities. And share your stories. And that we all can better get to know each other. We don't have to worry about a politician somewhere that has his notions of what he wants to sanitize our world. We don't have to do that. And so for me, it just made me feel that it's so important to continue the work that I do, which is to write the history, to research, first of all, to discover new things that we may not know, and to write the history. I remember when I was in college at University of Oregon, I had a professor that told me that the Civil War was not about slavery. It was about economics. I said, oh, but it was about people. He said, no. Well, they made money off of, It wasn't about slavery. It had nothing to do with slavery. And then I had a professor, when I worked in my graduate work, tell me that there were no slaves in California. These are educated. These are PhD people. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, how does this happen? It happens because we allow certain people to be the storytellers of our communities, and they're not any more legitimate as storytellers than we are. We need to tell our stories. We need to share our stories with one another, and that's a part of loving each other, is loving each other, sharing our stories, and accepting each other. There are very few researchers and writers that write on my topic, and there's a need for every community, every single community, to research their local history and to produce their stories and share their stories with the broader community.
Thank you for listening to Voices of Esalen. You can find all of Jan Adkins' books at AfricanAmericanHistories.com. Today's episode was produced in conjunction with Shira Levine. Our theme song is by Nico Holloman. The song, I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good, is by Duke Ellington and Ivy Anderson. Additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Until next time, be well.